Good morning. Your Honors, summary judgment was not appropriate in this case. There are substantial issues of fact and some misapplication and interpretation of both the facts and the law in this case, and I'm aware you're familiar with all the facts and will not repeat everything. There are two primary issues in this case. The first is there coverage and is Mr. John Doe deemed to be an insured? First off, there is no issue that he is not a named insured. It's not an issue in the case. His name does not appear in the policy. His father is a named insured. Also named insured on the policy, we contend, is Crescent Parts and Equipment, which is a family-owned business, himself, his father, his brothers, and another corporation also, GF Holdings. Now, defendant responded incorrectly cites in their brief that GF Holdings, for instance, they mention only the father. They only mention Mr. Giudice as being named insured. That is absolutely incorrect. If you look at the supplemental index prepared by the defendant, and if you look at the pages, and unfortunately my stamp pages on my copy are not legible, I didn't copy well, so I can't tell you exactly which page. But if you look at the insurance policies and the coverage pages that are attached, all the way through the entire time, we're in the coverage period for this particular claim that are applicable to these policies goes from 1987 to 1989. All the copies of the policies that are attached by the defendant show name insured, mailing address, George Giudice Sr., and it has a little sign, which is a subject of interpretation, Crescent Parts and Equipment. And then if you look to the next page, and this includes the policy that they've attached that goes through the period both of October of 88 to October of 89, and the policy period, the beginning, even as far back as when they first issued this policy in 85. The second page of the coverage pages also says the definition of insured is extended to include GF Holdings, Inc. There are corporations here. There are individuals. Now, this is a lake house. This is a very close, within an hour and a half so drive from the metropolitan area, St. Louis area. The lake house, no one lived at. This was only a summertime vacation type home. People would go in and out, including Mr. John Doe, and including with his relationship with Ms. Doe. The question becomes then, what is the household here? This is owned by Mr. Giudice and corporations, Your Honor. That's correct. Mr. Doe was both an officer of these corporations and a full-time employee of these corporations. No one lived there. The case is cited by the respondent, Watt versus Middlestat, and also referred to in the district court's order. Says talks about what is a household for purposes of the policy, and it cites White versus Middlestat. Says they live together as a single group or unit, which is of permanent and domestic character. Nobody lived at this home on a permanent basis. There was no permanent or domestic character on one roof at this residence. Plain and simple. So the fact of the matter is that this does apply to the lake house. There is liability, and if a corporation can be insured, if there is no coverage for officers of the corporation who use the home, the fact is that it's illusory coverage. Now, the one issue that was raised for the very first time in this court is that, and never in the trial court level, district court level, was the meaning of an ampersand versus a percentage sign. If you look at the way it's written, and it says name insured and mailing address, the very first line says George Giudice Sr. with a percentage sign, Crescent Parts and Equipment. What does that mean? Well, the defendant tells us that that's just a mailing address. That doesn't mean anything. The fact is that automatically creates an ambiguity in this policy, plain and simple. And if there's an ambiguity in the interpretation of the policy, casebook law nationally, Illinois and everywhere else, Missouri included, then the ambiguity is ruled against the insurer and in favor of coverage. Now, the next issue is liability for this particular case, and unfortunately, the district court dramatically ignored a significant part of our claim and the claims of negligence. This is an occurrence policy. It's not a claims-made policy. Under an occurrence policy, also black-letter law in every state, that it's a question of when the negligence acts and omissions occurred, regardless of when they're discovered. There is no case in Missouri that defendants cite, and no case that exists that says that when the person is diagnosed with the AIDS virus, or even at the moment they're infected, the HIV virus, that's when coverage starts. The negligence we claimed in this case is failure to warn of the dramatic, high-risk, sexual activity of Mr. John Doe, who, when directly asked by Ms. Doe if he was engaging in homosexual acts, he said no. And he said the reason was he didn't want people to think he was a homosexual. I'm not in any way or shape or form passing on the morals or ethics of his sexual preferences. But the fact is, he, according to the record, he was engaged, in his own admission, engaged in dramatically high-risk, unprotected homosexual sex with dozens and dozens of partners meeting in bars, hotels, public parks, sex for pay, he was paid, et cetera, et cetera. He denied this. He did not give, he failed to warn Ms. Doe. And when the negligence occurred, it is the first time that he engaged in sexual activities, which with Ms. Doe, which by both of their statements was the fall of 1987, during the coverage period. The fact that she wasn't diagnosed with AIDS till later is irrelevant. The fact that he was her only partner, and he died from AIDS. The fact that we can't say exactly which time, which sexual encounter led to the infection is also irrelevant. If the inference and the question of fact and the inference which the intent needs to be given to the plaintiff here, to Ms. Doe, is that if Mr. Doe would have properly advised her of his high-risk sexual activity, question of fact is would she have continued to have unprotected sexual relations with him? That's the negligence. The fact that the AIDS virus was may not transmitted the first time they had sex, the second time, the third time is irrelevant. Hypothetically, if I had a horrible flu and was coughing in my hand, and went around this courtroom and shook hands with everybody. The negligence is my not telling them, don't shake my hand, I have the flu. The fact that one out of five people would get that flu gives them their cause of action. But when my negligence occurs is by knowing that I have germs and viruses on my hand and I'm shaking everyone's hand, knowing that possibly someone could get infected by that. Unfortunately, that happens every day. So as far as those two issues, the court dramatically ignored and didn't even mention that issue. The court didn't even mention anything clearly on the policy where we know for a fact there is corporate ownership and corporate coverage because it says on the policy the definition of insured includes GF Holdings, Inc., and didn't address the issue on the front about George Giudice Sr., Crescent Parts and Equipment. Didn't address that issue at all in its order. The next issue, which I'll only touch on briefly, is the issue of assignment and relief, which was not put in our brief, and I'm sure where the court can discuss it. Looking at the children's, I'm getting into my white light just came on. Looking at the children's case and the, I'm aware, thank you, Your Honor. And the Krusinger case, the appellant cited, or respondent cited Childress. Krusinger case, without going into great detail because they're fairly complex interactions, Krusinger distinguished Childress. And in a case, the difference was, as in Krusinger, as in here. The fact is that the defendant, the insurance company, refused repeated requests to get involved in the case. Under those cases, the fact is that if the conduct of the insurance company, this is also cited in Childress, can allow them to be fully responsible for the judgment. In this case, the record is clear there was virtually no investigation of the insurance by the insurance company. The adjuster testified, as in our brief, that she was well aware that this policy existed on some other house. She had the policy number. She never requested it. She never investigated. She never got a copy of the policy. She never even looked to see who the named insureds on the policy were. She didn't do that until years later. This was beginning in, I believe, 1994. She didn't even look into that issue until 5 years later when the judgment was coming up and Mr. Doe's attorneys were again demanding coverage by the insurance company because the case was going on as it was. The other thing I'd like to mention, the defendant wants benefit of both Missouri and Illinois. And I think you have to pick your poison. The defendant in their brief even says this judgment is controlled by Illinois law. That's what they say in their brief. But then they go back to Missouri law saying that there's an Eighth Circuit case that says the judgments aren't assignable, and they cite the Quick case from the Eighth Circuit. And the Quick case says that the Ganaway versus Shelter case, the Missouri Appellate Court case, was wrong. Well, the problem is Ganaway was in 1990, Quick was in 1995. The next pronouncement by the same court that wrote Ganaway is in 2004, and in 2004 the same court in Missouri said, no, judgments are assignable in Missouri. But they do have to pick their poison. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm here, Bill Knapp, on behalf of Vigilant Insurance Company. There is no coverage under the subject policy and thus no duty to defend John Doe and no liability for the subsequent consent judgment that was entered against John Doe, which is the subject of this case. John Doe was not a resident of the Lake House located in Lake Ozark, Missouri, because he was not an insured under the subject policy. The policy on its face is clear that it was issued to John Doe's father and not to John Doe. He was not a named insured under the policy, as conceded by the appellant in this case. He was, in fact, according to the uncontroverted evidence in this case, a resident of his mother's household located at 5525 Wilson in St. Louis, Missouri. And that is the reason why, of course, as indicated in the record, State Farm paid its policy limits on behalf of Mr. John Doe, the insurer of the mother's residence. So it's clear that John Doe is not an insured under the policy as an individual, as a resident of the household of his father. There's an argument made and suggested here that somehow Crescent Parts Company is also an insured under the policy. The trial court found to the contrary, in fact found that there was no evidence in the record to support such a finding. Counsel for appellant has suggested that they didn't address that issue. That's not true. In their decision, they expressly addressed that issue, and they expressly rejected that argument, saying there was absolutely no evidence in the record that Crescent was an insured under the policy. And their determination in that regard was correct. Moreover, as the lower court correctly noted, even if Crescent were an insured under the policy, it would not supply coverage for acts such as those alleged to have been engaged in by John Doe, because it was a homeowner's policy. Now, there's been some suggestion in argument and in written submissions by appellant that in some sense this policy would be illusory. There's coverage for the named insured, John Doe's father, and for whoever may be residents of that household. The fact that the family chose to treat that home as a vacation home and nobody lived there on a full-time basis does not affect the scope of the coverage available under the policy. If somebody wants to move into that house and live there, that's at the election of the insured. That doesn't make coverage illusory. There's coverage available for residents of that household, of that place, if somebody wants to live there. If they choose not to, that does not make the policy illusory. I'm sorry, cover what? Well, I think not. I don't think, and I think that's part of the another consideration is that it would not provide coverage for this kind of conduct as alleged in this case. The counsel also attempts to parse and split hairs on this issue as to the manifestation of disease or the date of infection or the date of diagnosis, but makes the rather comical argument that it's the date when you fail to warn somebody they might be at risk is the date that constitutes an occurrence under the policy. That's ludicrous, cites no authority for that proposition. There is no law that would support the proposition that if I fail to warn 10 people I might affect them with HIV, that they all have a cause of action by virtue of my failure to warn them, even if they never developed the disease. That's comical and obviously not supported by the law. The fact of the matter is that the plaintiff cannot prove here that her infection, Jane Doe's infection with HIV, occurred during the policy period, and that's exactly what the trial court found. There is absolutely no way without engaging in speculation for any finder of fact to make a determination that the infection occurred during the applicable policy period, because the policy was from 1985 to 1989. The relationship between John and Jane Doe was from 1987 to 1981, and so there's a considerable lack of congruence with the dates in question. Counsel has argued in brief, not here before this court, that an inference could be made from the evidence that the infection did occur during the policy period. Cites no legal authority for that proposition, either in his original brief or in his reply. And in fact, there is no law that would support such a supposition. And in fact, any such conclusion based on the evidence would be nothing more than speculation, as the court below correctly noted. We have also, the suggestion of counsel has been that the Childress analysis with regard to the consent judgment is not correct. He suggested to the court this morning that the Crutzinger case distinguished Childress. That, in fact, is a temporal impossibility. The Crutzinger case was decided in 1956, the Childress case in 1968. The Kretzinger case could not have distinguished Childress, and in fact, Childress is the principle of law that applies here, and that is that if the insured is insulated from any obligation for the underlying consent judgment, then there's no damage, and therefore no basis to bring a claim for bad faith or for an excess judgment. $100,000, yes. That's my understanding, yes. The exact reason for their settlement does not appear of record. That was the nature of the suit at the time that they settled the case. Their reasons for doing so do not appear of record, and we don't know for a fact what those were for. I would just say this issue of assignability under Missouri law, the case law is clear. The Ganaway case, which is referenced, had to do with assignment pursuant to a bankruptcy proceeding. And as the Eighth Circuit correctly noted in the Quick case, which we have cited, when there's a statutory basis for making the assignment of a claim, then that statutory basis is valid and supportable. But absent some statutory basis for doing so, such assignments are not permitted. The more recent case, the Freeman case versus Basso, upon which a plaintiff relies in this case, was a medical malpractice case and not a bad faith insurance case, and so is inapposite. And I would just simply say in conclusion that the trial court, as indicated in its determination in the below, stated that it carefully and painstakingly scrutinized not only the law but the record below before reaching its decision and issuing its lengthy decision in this case, not once but twice, once on original consideration and a second time on reconsideration. Their conclusion is supported by the law, by the evidence, the facts that appeared of record below, and we would request that this court affirm the district court's decision. Glen Carbon is just right next door to Edwardsville in Madison County. Thank you, Your Honor.
Allow me to get set up for 10, please. Thank you. First question. There is no sexual activity exclusion in their policy. There is currently sexual exclusion in insurance policies. There is not in this one. There was in the State Farm policy. Second issue. The trial court did not at all consider Crescent Parts. Take a look at the ruling. You won't see that word anywhere. Third point, proximate cause. The issue of proximate cause, you have to deal with when was the negligence, which then it's an occurrence policy. There's a Missouri case also that talks about what the about insurance about that, and unfortunately it is. I'm using up my time. The fact is, though, that the State Farm paid the policy because there was no exclusion. It covered a different part of it also. There is coverage. There is an ambiguity in the insured. It was not addressed at all by the trial court. Thank you, Your Honor.